Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First off in our show, we're going to hear from a motivational speaker whose work has a great potential to impact individuals with disabilities. We're going to hear from Dr. Mahmoud Majwi. So, your work in motivational speaking has a tremendous potential to impact people to live their best lives. Can you tell me a little bit about your background in this?
Sure. So, by profession, I'm a dental surgeon. So, I'm a dentist by profession. But I realized about 15 years into my career, which was 3 years ago, that I wanted to just do something more, be more, become more, give more. There were certain things which were holding me back. I wanted to be able to speak, I wanted to be able to help people, inspire people, but I had a stutter which was holding me back. And one of my journeys came to actually break my stutter, to be able to empower others. So now what my gift is to be able to show people that they can actually do anything, that potentially limitless, and you can tap into whatever you want to pluck out the noise. And so what I do when I work with people is I give them strategies, show them ways in which they can actually get to wherever they want to get to.
So this could potentially benefit a lot of people with disabilities, those who just don't think they have anything to offer society. So what's the potential impact from your end?
See, I believe everyone is actually born with limitless potential. Okay, so we're all born average. We have an unlimited amount of potential. Whether you're living with a disability or not, you've got so much which you need to give the world, whatever that may be. And my point is that sometimes when you're living with a disability, life gets very tough. And there's two things that people prefer in the world, and that's hope and leadership. The hope of a better life than you have now, and an actual leader who can help you unlock that. So for me, working with people with disabilities is like working with anyone else, that I know how much potential they have, but I want them to see it. I want them to realize what their gift is. I want them to unlock their true self and then actually go on and live.
So are there any challenges in the work you do in inspiring people to live their best lives?
Yeah. A lot of people, they kind of complain that they want a better life, but they don't want a better life. Like, I know that if someone wants to create that ultimate life for themselves, you've got to be getting well outside of your comfort zone. You've got to be doing things you never thought you'd be doing. And so a lot of the challenges initially comes where people want to do so much, but then they don't want to do what it takes to get there. I always say if you want a special life, you've got to do special things. And my point is how I can unlock you to do the special things. So sometimes, early on, number one, people can't see. See, I always say that everyone's got a purpose in life. And what I mean by that is it's something unique which you're put on this earth to do. So just like we've got a finger right now, and no one has the same fingerprint as you, there's only something which you're put here to do. That's it. And no one else can do it like you. And if you don't do it, then one day you'll be questioned on it. And one of the biggest things is for people to realize what their purpose is. And so one of the biggest challenges, one of my biggest passions is to actually find everyone's purpose. Because everyone's like, you know, what's my purpose? I don't know. What's my passion? I don't know. What should I be doing? And so one of the biggest things I do is actually to unlock that for people, to show them what their passion, what their purpose is.
So in your work, what's been the greatest success you've experienced?
The greatest success I've experienced is taking someone from where they believe they can't do something to actually doing it. So it's not about the dollar. It's not about anything else. See, I always say that people will always forget what you said. People will always forget what you do. But people will never forget how you made them feel. There's a lady called Maya Angelou who actually said that. And that hits me hard. But, you know, if you can change how you make people feel, you can change the world. So for me, it's the great success isn't about... So I've coached people from startups all the way to billionaires. And it's not about dollar or anything like that. What it's about is whoever it is, taking them from a place where they didn't think something is possible to actually getting them to see that they can do it. And I feel that's the biggest gift that we can give anyone.
So recently you were involved in an event to do some motivational speaking. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, so I'm based in London, England, and I was asked to come to an event which Smile were running over here, and they asked me to come and give a keynote talk at a fundraising dinner they were having. And the title of it was The Future of Our Children. But how can we create a great future for our children? Because sometimes many of us, we can't see a better future for our kids than we've had ourselves. So my task on that evening was to be able to... So I've got 6 points, which we spoke about that night. But what we need to do as parents to unlock the true potential of our children. But I always say that in order to get the best out of others, we've got to be the best ourselves. So the journey becomes perfecting ourselves to be our kids to be the best. So you want your kids to do something, well, we do it first. So the whole talk that night was about how to empower yourself and then go on to empower your kids. That was the theme of that night. So I spoke about 6 ways in which we could do that.
So for any person with a disability who is a young child who might be struggling, hearing the words and the encouragement of a parent would probably get them out of that comfort zone, as you say, and really change the course. So I think that's a great impact your work has the potential to have right there.
Thank you.
So where can people go about finding more information about the work you do?
Monica, the best place to go is either on Facebook or Instagram, on Instagram and Facebook. If you just type my name in, which is Mahmood Maoji, that's MahmoodMawje. If you type that on Instagram, you go straight to my page, and I'd love to be able to try and inspire you with the content which I push out daily. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In the next segment of our show, we'll hear from Sunil Bodai about the dangers of self-medicating in treating depression and mental illness. So, what are some of the dangers associated with self-medicating when it comes to depression or mental illness?
Well, it's always going to be dangerous because a person who is taking it upon themselves to medicate their feelings and emotions, like depression, wouldn't necessarily know what the right thing to do is, or even if what they're doing is appropriate. So currently, a lot of people are medicating different things by using marijuana, and they're taking it upon themselves to just use the substance, thinking that the substance is a cure-all. So for someone who is suffering any kind of mental health disorder, if they're using any substance, including alcohol or any other substance that alleviates the feeling, those substances can be often uncontrolled as far as doses are concerned and things like that as well. And it can develop into an addiction quite easily based on the fact that they're compensating for something in a very uncontrolled kind of way. So that's, in my opinion, the major danger.
So I'm guessing this would just be a temporary cure anyway, that they would need it in greater and greater doses, thus leading to the addiction.
Right. That's one of the factors that creates that addiction, is the fact that with substances that you use that are unregulated, what can happen is your body builds tolerance, obviously. So take alcohol as a classic example that most people would recognize. The more you drink, the more your tolerance is, therefore you need to use more in order to get the same effect. So if you're self-medicating, then the feeling that you get that alleviates whatever you're feeling of depression or whatever it is, it's going to take more and more in order to have that same effect on that feeling of depression.
So do you find there are a lot of myths out there, misinformation?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of misinformation out there. I mean, just also say that there is a lot of information out there that's actually realistic. So I saw a doctor earlier this week, and I have cholesterol issues. And the doctor informed me that there are two major things that help deal with high bad cholesterol. And one of those things happens to be alcohol, and the other one is exercise. So when he said alcohol to me, I said, seriously, alcohol is something that would help my cholesterol to be lower. And then he caught himself and he said, well, I'm not encouraging you to drink, but I'm informing you that alcohol does help cholesterol. So just thinking about the fact that if I had the propensity to drink, or I had addiction in my family and I heard that, I would begin drinking in order and using the excuse that I'm dealing with my cholesterol, right? So there's that. There's actually real information out there around substances like alcohol that could actually create people medicating themselves and therefore becoming addicted to the substance, right? But there is a lot of misinformation out there around, again, for something like marijuana, that is it's a cure-all for everything, or that, no matter what the ailment is, you just use whatever the substance is and you will get better. I mean, among substance users, using communities as well, I mean, in order to deal with anything that you're going through in life, so say among young people who are dealing with breakups and so on, right? Just go out there and get smashed and you'll feel better the next day, that kind of stuff. It's classic examples of self-medication.
So for someone, for example, who's addicted but also expecting a child, I assume the risks would be even greater. I mean, you can delude yourself into saying, oh, nothing will happen, but the realities are the risk remains.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if a woman's pregnant, then for sure the risks are very, very high around any kind of substance use, right?
So when it comes to that, if they use the justification, say, oh, a little won't hurt, I assume that's complete myth right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is, people talk about the fact that in previous generations, women drank alcohol and smoked throughout pregnancies, and it wasn't an issue, right? But currently, they're saying any little amount can actually have an effect. So what you're really doing is playing Russian roulette with intaking any substances while you're pregnant.
So if you could send any message to the community about the risks involved with self-medicating and playing fast and loose, what would you say?
It isn't worth the risk, absolutely. I mean, in order to get any mental health disorder or any even physical disorder dealt with properly, it's essential that you see a medical professional and be monitored around any kind of substance that you're intaking, even prescribed substance, right? So if you're dealing with chronic pain, say, and you're being prescribed an opiate in order to deal with that, it needs to be monitored on a consistent basis. Therefore, if it sort of starts leaning toward becoming an addiction, it can be dealt with appropriately and in a timely manner by the professional that's hopefully monitoring you appropriately.
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, not a problem.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Come on, come on.
How much did your band make at your last show? What if I told you that you could make an additional $75 per gig? SOCAM members who perform registered original material may be eligible for payment. What is SOCAM, you ask? SOCAM is a Society of Composers, Authors, and Music Publishers of Canada, the Canadian copyright collective that administers the performing rights of more than 90,000 members. For details on how to get paid for your music and for free registration, adjust your web browser to socan.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Dr. Mahmoud Majwi, a motivational speaker, and from Sunil Bodai from Renaissance about the dangers of self-medicating. Next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Chad Andrews from the Foundation Fighting Blindness. So tell me a little bit about the foundation.
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to mention is that we're not called the Foundation Fighting Blindness any longer, although you may not know that just because the change is so recent. Earlier this year, we announced that we're going to be called Fighting Blindness Canada. And really, this is just to connect the organization to a number of different ones internationally that use that same kind of naming structure, Fighting Blindness Ireland, for example. So we're now Fighting Blindness Canada, and we think that the name change really kind of, says rather directly what we're all about and leads to a lack of confusion that that term foundation kind of suggests. And really, you know, what we do, the main thing that we do is raise and direct funds for vision science in Canada. That's the most obvious way of putting it. So, and we've actually been doing that since 1974. That's when the organization was founded, although it was called something differently back then as well.
So how do you go about spreading the word about the work you do?
Through a variety of different formats, actually. So one of the things that we do is, and we've been doing this for over 40 years, is connect with patients directly through in-person educational sessions and through other means. So yes, absolutely, we're an organization that raises funds to advance vision science, but we're also a community of individuals affected by vision loss and blindness. So right now, we hold a educational session called Vision Quest across Canada. And that educational series is designed to get patients up to speed on what's happening in the world of vision science, and also to connect them with one another, but also with scientists and researchers and industry representatives, stakeholders from government, and other individuals. So it's really one of the best examples of collaborative community building in the space of vision research.
So, when you mentioned fundraising efforts, are there any challenges in actually pulling that off?
Yeah, there are definitely challenges. Historically, we've been an events-based organization, and that's still the case to some degree today. And what I mean by events-based is that we raise the majority of our funds through events that we have. So we have an event called Cycle for Sight. In fact, we're going to have a Cycle for Sight tomorrow in Toronto. And that just involves individuals from the community and elsewhere raising funds and then getting on a bicycle for the day and, riding for 25, 50, or 100 kilometers to raise awareness and to raise money for vision science in Canada. So there's Cycle for Sight. We also have an event called Ride for Sight, which is essentially the same thing, but it's for motorcyclists instead of cyclists. And then we have a comedy event called Comic Vision, which is fantastic. Every single year, it's remarkable and quite funny, but it's comedians on stage in front of a group of people who are invested in some way in vision loss and vision science. But the challenge with those events is that, yes, that can get us there, and we've really done an amazing job, using those as a means for raising and directing funds where they need to go. But accelerating vision science is enormously expensive. It's not just a bunch of scientists in a lab with their test tubes. It's really this enormous infrastructure and apparatus that is necessary to get that science from the lab and into the market in the form of treatments that are available for Canadians. So we're finding other ways to raise money as well, and that includes online fundraising and a number of other initiatives that we have underway.
So in your time with the foundation, what's been the greatest success that you've seen?
Greatest success? Yeah, well, I've been with the organization for about 2.5 years now, so I haven't been here a long time necessarily. I have colleagues who've been here for 10 or more years. But I've seen a lot of transformation taking place. And I think that if you're working in the nonprofit sector at all, you can probably say that that's the case, just because the sector and the way that people donate to organizations has changed so dramatically over the last 5 or 10 years. One success I would like to highlight, and it's probably because it's specific to my role at the organization, which is focused on research and policy. One success I'd probably highlight is the ways that we're interacting with diverse stakeholders more so than ever. I think it's probably fair to say that in the past, especially going back 10 or 20 or more years, we've probably been largely focused on just interacting with the community and with the scientists. But what we have realized now more so than ever is that we have to network with government and industry as well. And really the reason for that is because a lot of the science that we've been advancing over the last 40 plus years is starting to materialize as actual treatments, which is quite exciting. So we've been saying that we're going to cure blindness now for a long time. And what is starting to emerge are actual legitimate treatments that improve the lives of individuals affected by vision loss. And of course, what that means is that we have to find ways not just to advance science, but to connect the science to individuals in Canada and elsewhere. So it's to actually connect patients to treatments. And that is going to mean broader efforts with industry and government to make sure that we're finding ways to make those treatments accessible. So that's the success I'd like to highlight, is that we're actually making those inroads. We're engaged in a number of policy initiatives. We're talking to government stakeholders all the time. We're working with industry to make their treatments available. And I think that we've moved we've moved those activities forward rather tremendously over the last 2 or 3 years.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. When it comes to self-medicating and all the issues surrounding it, one could argue it's a matter of choice, and allowing a person with a disability the freedom of choice does mean that sometimes they'll make the wrong one, or a questionable one. But to my way of thinking, especially among pregnant women and young people, you don't know the risks you're taking. You don't know what you're doing with your life. It's easy in this day and age to say, it's legal, therefore it must be safe, it must be acceptable. But honestly, are the side effects worth it? Are all the things that could potentially happen worth the 5 minutes you feel better? And the truth is, a person with a disability, like anyone in society, will sometimes get down. They will get depressed. And a lot of that can stem from a place of not feeling respected or valued or understood. I mean, for example, if a person with a disability comes and says, I'm having a problem with this other person here in this business. Can you please help me with this? They should be heard. They should be acknowledged just as much as anyone else. And when they are not heard and they are not respected, it comes from a place where they start to feel they're not as valuable in society. They don't have as much to contribute. I would argue against that 100%. For everyone has something to contribute. whether we treat them with the respect and the dignity that we would any other, whether they move a little differently, speak a little differently, act a little differently. It's not our place to judge anyone's story or what led them to the decisions they've made. It's not our place to tell them, we're going to help you, but only because you bring a lot of money to this business, or we're going to help you because, well, because you got dirt on us or something. Truth is, if we don't look at people as potential equal members of society, we're devaluing something that goes beyond simple incidents. You know what happens in a moment. We all do. But you never do see what happens once a person's out the door. Do they take a situation well? Do they end up self-medicating and really hurting themselves, all because somebody used an unkind word with them? Do they have to give up something that they love because someone overlooked them as a meaningless member of society? Which there aren't any, by the way. Society is made up of people, not judges. Yes, some are technically judges by profession, by the fact that they have earned such rank. But how is it we put the value on a person's life simply by saying, we're not going to be there for you. We're not going to give you what you need to prevent you from taking an act that could harm yourself, or worse still, an innocent child who has no say in the matter whatsoever? I maintain hopelessness is one of the biggest disabilities of all, and that's what leads people to want to self-medicate. All they see is the pain that they're in and the need for relief, the need to just get out of the rut. And some people will do anything to do that, whether it be a bad relationship, self-medicating, or, in the extreme case, just turning violent and aggressive. And people have done it simply because others couldn't see them as a living, breathing, thinking human being. And sometimes, even a human being with a valid story to tell and a valid point to share. And honestly, when did it become a matter of recognizing the value of money or the value of influence over the value of the person? You can't say that one person in society matters more than another, because if a young person is properly steered, you don't know what they're going to accomplish. You don't know who they're going to grow up to be. They might grow up to be just a drain on society, but not with the right support, not with the right guidance. So, the question is to each of us, who are we? Are we the people who value life and respect the freedom to choose? Or are we the people who go out of our way to tear each other down and perpetuate those outdated notions that a person can only do so much, especially a person with a disability? We the ones to say, because you're different, because you're not our comfortable little model of what a person should be, you're not going to be included. You're not going to be a part of our little clique. Are we really all living such small lives? Or, as I believe, are we the ones who can build each other up and create for our future? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.